I'm a good driver. I look for cars. I pay attention. I should have seen the little girl in the crosswalk.
Please, look for pedestrians. Stop for them. Think of the impact you could make. A message from the Federal Highway Administration.
Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder. Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world, here on Valley Free Radio, or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in!
We don't care if they laugh at us. Let a big bus and need a sickle for us. They can have a Cadillac and Tiva too, but give me my rocket bicycle for two.
Thanks for tuning in today. It's Wednesday, May 25th. I'm live here in the studio with Dwayne Rainey.
In prison.
Thanks for leaving your garden plot to come in the studio with me today, Dwayne.
It's always a pleasure.
So today's show.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Happy birthday, Alex Jarrett.
Happy birthday, Alex Jarrett.
Woo, woo, 41. I mean, 19.
So, oh yeah, that reminds me of this, someone that said something to me today when I was out doing my route. I was picking up in a residential neighborhood in Northampton. I was stopped loading up the trailer, picking up household trash, recycling, and compost, and a couple of women walked by on the sidewalk, and one of them, she was an athletic-looking, middle-aged woman. She stopped, and she said to me in a hush-hush kind of way, she's like, I have a question for you, and don't worry, I won't tell anyone what you say. Now tell me, do you like your job? I was kind of floored, actually, because, like, who in their right mind would do this kind of work if they didn't enjoy it?
So true.
You'd be kind of miserable and probably hurt yourself. And so I said, I love it. Be honest, she said. I just shrugged, because, like, what else am I going to say? How long have you been doing it? She asked me, and I thought for a minute, about 14 years. Oh, wow, do you own the business? I said, yeah, we all do. We're our own bosses, and we set our own hours, and the pay is good, and it's fun and healthy. You should ask any other pedal person you see if they enjoy their job, if you don't believe me. The woman's friend said she could do this job, and I said, I bet she could. At least four of us are over 40, and we're hiring. We'll see if we get an application from her.
Yeah, I always think, like, if I pick up a trailer, I start pedaling around. I just start singing On the Road Again. It's just nice to pull on a trailer and be out there and free.
Yeah, that actually kind of reminds me. I read this thing in terms of songs. I read this thing about 10 most dangerous songs to drive to. They didn't say the most dangerous songs to bike to. That'd probably be a totally different list. But they say the number one most dangerous song.
Death metal.
Well, they say rock and roll is most dangerous. And the one on this list, I don't know, this is from like 2013 or 2014, I think, is Hey Mama by the Black Eyed Peas. So don't play that song while you're driving. At least don't dance in the car or something. Anyway, oh yeah, today's show, we're going to talk a little bit more about driving and accidents. I saw an article in the New York Times this morning that caught my eye that I wanted to talk about a little bit. And accidents and incidents. And then the second half, the second two thirds of the show will be an interview with my friend David Perez. He's someone that he's a friend from Chicago. When I was traveling in April, I visited Chicago and hung out with him for a bit and got a little interview from him about his 28 years in state prison on a murder charge.
He's a really nice guy, though.
Yes, he's a nice guy. People change.
I mean, I'm serious.
Yeah, you met him. Yeah, he's a nice guy. And what else? Okay, well, I have another little anecdote. So earlier this year on one of my trips. And I was hitchhiking and I got picked up by a couple of guys who were electricians. They're going home from a job. And I'd been standing by the side of the road for a while. So I was pretty grateful when they offered me a ride in their truck with all their electrician supplies. And during the ride, they started talking about the work they were doing at HUD apartment complexes. And the driver said to the passenger, or maybe it was to me too, he said, "I still can't believe what happened down there at that place where that effing N-word, B-word came out there and unplugged our cord. That's a N-word if I ever see one." And so I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to have to say something here. But I'm at their mercy, in their truck, on their terms.
They could have pushed you out.
They could have pushed me out.
55.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to make any enemies. Like, I was a recipient of their hospitality and wanting to build bridges and not walls. So, like, what do I say here? So I said, wait, what? And he said, "Well, we was doing some work in this apartment complex, and it wasn't even hooked up to her power. There was a plug on the outside, and we plugged in an extension cord, and she went to raising hell." And the other guy said, "We was doing a sewer inspection where you run a camera down through the sewer drain. Yeah, she did a treatment on us because we had a cord plugged into her outside outlet. She was throwing a fit." And I said, "So she just went out there and unplugged it on you?" "Yeah, and it wasn't even hooked up to her power." "Yeah, it wasn't even her power." "Well, did she think it was her power?" I asked. "Well, we didn't know whose it was. It was like a motel with 5 units, and they just build outside outlets on the porch. It was only 5 minutes, like 5 minutes worth of power. I think she just wanted some cigarettes." "That'll be worth $5, she said to us. "What's that, a dollar a minute? But she had free power." "Hmm," I said. And he said, I'd have bought her a darn pack of cigarettes if she'd wanted." And I suggested, "Well, maybe you could call her something that's not a racist term." "Huh?" I said, "Well, maybe you could call her something that's not a racist term besides N-word." "I don't know what it was," one guy mumbled. "Yeah, I'm not a racist person," the other one said. "I'm not either, you know, but she was just being a a-hole, I don't know." "A-hole," I said. "There you go. That'll suffice." And the passenger said, "I don't know if she was just having a bad day or what was going on." "Yeah," I said, "maybe it was just one more thing that was just pissing her off." And then there was silence between us, and then they started talking about the cop car that had come into sight. And
they don't like them either?
I don't think so.
I'd like to hear what they had to say about them.
So, yeah, is it like policing someone's language? Is there any point to that? Oh, that's like a loaded term to call it policing someone's language. Anyway, what would you have done in my situation? Or what have you done in similar situations? Or what did you wish you did? If you have a story or thought or any advice, call in. The number's 585-1033. I might not be able to figure out how to put you on the air, but Dwayne can relay your message if I can't.
Eventually.
585-1033. And thanks for listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio.
And you don't have to give us your name.
Nope. Okay. So, what else? All right. So, I said I was going to... Oh, there go my papers. I said I was going to talk about this article I saw and then I read in the New York Times this morning. Yeah. Where's my papers? So I was emptying downtown trash and, you know, papers come and papers go. And there's this paper and this headline caught my eye it says, "It's no accident. Call it a car crash instead, advocates insist." This is from Monday, May 23rd, 2016, by Matt Richtel. Richtel. Here, I got to read this. "Roadway fatalities are soaring at a rate not seen in 50 years, resulting from crashes, collisions, and other incidents caused by drivers. Just don't call them accidents anymore." That's the position of a growing number of safety advocates, including grassroots groups, federal officials, and state and local leaders across the country. They're campaigning to change a 100-year-old mentality that they say trivializes the single most common cause of traffic incidents, human error. "When you use the word accident, it's like God made it happen," Mark Rosekind, the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, said at a driver safety conference this month at the Harvard School of Public Health. "In our society," he added, "language can be everything. Almost all crashes stem from driver behavior like drinking, distracted driving, and other risky activity." I think that'd be 94%, because then it says about 6% are caused by vehicle malfunctions, weather, and other factors. Preliminary estimates by the nonprofit National Safety Council show deadly crashes rose by nearly 8% in 2015 over the previous year, killing about 38,000 people. Dr. Rose Kine, the guy from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, has added his voice to a growing chorus of advocates who say the persistence of crashes, driving is the most dangerous activity for most people. The persistence of crashes can be explained in part by widespread apathy toward the issue. Yeah, fear is not usually based on reality, so people don't really fear it. Anyway, changing semantics is meant to shake people, particularly policymakers, out of the implicit nobody's fault attitude that the word accident conveys. On January 1st, the state of Nevada enacted a law passed almost unanimously in the legislature to change accident to crash in dozens of instances where the word is mentioned in state laws, like those covering police and insurance reports. And New York City adopted a policy in 2014 to reduce fatalities. They adopted a policy to reduce fatalities that states the city must no longer regard traffic crashes as mere accidents. And other cities, including San Francisco, has taken the same step. At least 28 state departments of transportation have moved away from the term accident when referring to roadway incidents, according to Jeff Larrison, director of highway safety for Massachusetts. The Traffic Safety Administration changed its own policy in 1997, but has recently become more vocal about the issue. Mr. Larrison, the guy from Massachusetts, a former TV traffic reporter, started a blog called Drop the A-Word and has led a campaign to get major media outlets to stop using the term. Last year, he enlisted supporters to join with grassroots groups in urging the Associated Press to clarify how reporters should use the word accident. In April, the Associated Press announced a new policy. When negligence is claimed or proven in a crash, the new entry reads, reporters should avoid accident, which can be read by some as a term exonerating the person responsible. But the use of accident has its defenders, as Mr. Larrison discovered in 2014 when he posted his thoughts on the word in a Facebook group popular among traffic reporters. Why can't human error be an accident, even if the error is preventable, one person wrote. What's being solved by having this debate? What injustice are we correcting? And when Mr. Larrison suggested to officials at the Virginia Department of Transportation that they stop using accident, he received a note saying that drivers are familiar and comfortable with the word. Virginia officials also wrote that drivers might not consider a minor incident to be a crash, and so the change could be confusing. Mr. Larrison counters that accident is simply the wrong word. I'm betting it's one of the most commonly used words that is used inappropriately, he said. On Facebook, he posted a Merriam-Webster definition that describes accident as, quote, an unexpected happening that is not due to any fault or misconduct on the part of the person injured, end quote. The word was introduced into the lexicon of manufacturing and other industries in the early 1900s, when companies were looking to protect themselves from the costs of caring for workers who were injured on the job, according to Peter Norton, a historian and associate professor at the University of Virginia's Department of Engineering. Safety campaigns started calling these events accidents, which excused the employer of responsibility, Dr. Norton said. When traffic deaths spiked in the 1920s, a consortium of auto industry interests, including insurers, borrowed the word to shift the focus away from the cars themselves. Automakers were very interested in blaming reckless drivers, Dr. Norton said. But over time, he said, the word has come to exonerate the driver, too, with accident seeming like a lightning strike beyond anyone's control. The word accident, he added, is seen by its critics as having normalized mass death in this country, whereas the word crash is a resurrection of the enormity of this catastrophe. Though I think, Dwayne, I think we just get used to the word crash, too.
Well, they don't have accident test dummies. They're crash test dummies.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it.
Yeah. Let's see. So, when New York City changed its policy in 2014, it did so partly in response to grassroots efforts, including from a group called Families for Safe Streets. The group is led by parents like Amy Cohen, whose son, Sammy, was run over and killed in Brooklyn in 2013. She helped start a campaign called Crash Not Accident, and said that the drivers in deadly wrecks should not be given the presumption of innocence just because they have lived to tell their side of the story. Whose story do you have at the time of the crash? The driver. The victim is dead, Ms. Cohen said. The presumption should be to call it a crash, which is a neutral term. Anyway.
I mean, even on the news, if you have, they show an accident, they don't show anybody, like, all messed up. But I think news out of Puerto Rico where they just show the car upside down with a person in it. And it's just, yeah, this is going to happen to you if you don't, like, watch what you're doing. But they don't do it in our media, so I guess that's an accident.
Okay, here's a couple of words from Paul Simon.
All along, there were incidents and accidents. There were hints and allegations. If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long-lost pal. I can call you Betty, and Betty, when you call.
I just wanted to play that for the incidents and accidents and hints and allegations. So there's another thing that these statistics made me think of in terms of car crashes. Like, I can say for me, I'm afraid of cars. They seem like really risky behavior to me. I was at a driver's ed class over the weekend with one of my coworkers, Brett. We're doing a presentation at Berkshire Driving School in East Hampton. They've invited us from Pedal People as cyclists to come talk about sharing the road. And someone was talking about the fatalities, statistics of fatalities. Is it dangerous to ride a bike? And what I've heard is that if you compare, usually when you look at crash statistics, people often look at miles traveled, like how many deaths or accidents per mile, I think. But if you compare time spent, I don't think riding a bike is any more dangerous than driving because, it takes us so much longer to get places. So per minute, I think it's about the same. And again, like with any way you travel, the individual has a lot of choice in what they can do to be safe in terms of,
Don't text.
Don't text.
Ride. Get off your phone. I'm going to get a t-shirt.
Ride with traffic.
Off your phone and drive. But then they'll see my t-shirt and then it'll crack up.
And another thing that I wanted to talk about transportation safety was, so one really safe way to get around if you don't walk or bike is to take the bus. And I was looking on the PVTA's website, and the National Safety Council estimates that riding the bus is, guess Dwayne, how many times safer is riding the bus than automobile travel?
You mean like lately? There's been a lot of bus accidents.
Really?
So, yeah. I mean, just killing like whatever.
Okay, well, I'm not sure on this statistic if it's local public transportation.
Sack it to me.
Okay, so anyway, so riding the bus is over 170 times safer than automobile travel.
I might have said 165 times.
I'm sure you would have. So here's my little plug for the bus. It's from a public health point of view in so many ways. Improve the air. You'll probably improve your health because you'll probably walk a little bit further to get to or from the bus.
Or chase it. Remember the guy in Knoxville? What was his name?
I can't remember, but he was running after that bus for like a quarter mile through the streets of downtown Knoxville.
He got off when he shouldn't have.
All right, remember that. Riding the bus is over 170 times safer than automobile travel. All right, Dwayne's got a song. Who is this, Dwayne?
Sammy Hagar. Good driving, Tom.
Hey,
Dwayne, thanks for that.
Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar.
Yep, thanks for that selection, Dwayne.
That would just be my running song when I drove. When I drove.
When you drove, yeah. It's actually a good reminder, though, that just driving more slowly is really important. It can go a long way towards reducing fatalities.
I think it was like in the 70s when we had that gasoline shortage that they reduced the speed on the highways to 55 to save on gas.
Yeah.
But I guess now it's like 65.
Or greater in some places. Yeah. All right. We're going to play a couple more announcements. What?
Oh, announcement?
Oh, yeah. You got an announcement, Dwayne?
Who's going to miss this one? See, it was May 30th.
That's coming up. That's Monday.
That's right.
Memorial Day.
Yes, it's the Holyoke Ferris Wheel. Or not Ferris Wheel, merry-go-round.
Put it on its side. It'll be a Ferris wheel.
Okay, yeah. No, nobody will care. Yeah, it's opening. It's from noon till 4. And they have, I guess it's going to be open like, this is the start of spring in Holyoke.
And free rides for veterans at the end of Memorial Day?
I guess so.
To hide your head, a merry-go-round story? Anecdote? Joke?
Guy was being chased by a tiger and a lion and a bear or something, and his friend said, so what'd you do? He says, they just said, get off the merry-go-round, you drunk.
I'm sorry, I gave away the punchline almost. Okay, well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm going to play the interview with my friend David from Chicago in a couple minutes, and talking about his time involved in gangs and prison and in some changes that he made. Now, since summer is here and I spent a lot of my morning picking trash out of the recycling, I'm going to play this.
This is Ruthie from Pedal People with a public service announcement. If you frequent downtown Northampton or Florence and you pass by the recycling and trash bins on the street, the public ones, I'm here to let you know that cups are not recyclable. No plastic cups, no paper cups, no styrofoam cups, no clear cups, red cups, blue cups, yellow cups, no insulated cups. Because if you put cups in the recycling bin, it means either I pick them out or someone at the sorting facility picks them out in Springfield, or it contaminates the whole load too much that the whole load is considered trash. Or if you can just bring your own cup altogether and not have disposable cups, that'd be even better. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your cooperation.
Classical music returns to Valley Free Radio. Tune in to Andy Musique Wednesday mornings at 6 a.m. for an hour of beautiful music to start your day, hosted by Lucy and Larry.
All right, listeners, this is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton, in Florence, actually. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. So for the rest of the show, I have an interview with my friend David. Actually, I used to live in Chicago, but I moved to Northampton in 2002. I actually met him through friends of friends. Well, he was locked up when we started writing letters because I was writing a friend of his, and the friend got out and passed my name on to David. And then I ended up writing David for several years. We had a pretty good correspondence. And then he got out, I believe, in like 2008, 2009, after spending 28 years in jail. So this is an interview with him that we had in April.
David, tell me a little bit about your teenage years.
Oh, my teenage years. My teenage years were pretty good. Growing up a normal kid, and one thing led to another. I was doing good in school, and then I started hanging out with little gangs in my neighborhood, in my area, because I grew up with these guys, and eventually I became a gang member. But I think what initiated the move in becoming a gang member was the fact that I was with a friend one morning, one Saturday morning, and he got shot, and die right there in front of me. And that opened the door for revenge on my part. You know, I was 14 years old and wasn't thinking straight. Actually, my mistake, I was 15 years old and wasn't thinking straight. And all of a sudden, I wanted to be a gang member, you know, in order to enact revenge. And a short time later, we retaliated against the rival gang. I got locked up. I was incarcerated for a home invasion, attempt murder, because we had followed this guy to his house. Then I was eventually released after 30 days to my, you know, parents, you know, on my own reconnaissance. And from there, things just escalated. I became more involved in the gang, and I'll say a year later, I ended up really messing up. And
can we go back just a minute? And I'm wondering, when you were 14, 15, and you saw this person get shot in front of you, what was that like?
It was crazy. It looked like everything happened in slow motion, and if I wanted to stop it, no matter how slow we went, I couldn't have stopped it. I was not close enough to the guy that pulled the gun, and it happened so fast that, like I said, it was slow motion. I wasn't thinking clear. After he shot my friend, I actually chased the guy, and he turned around and went to shoot at me, and the gun he had got jammed, you know, so there was a car waiting for him in the alley, so he ran to the car and got away. I don't know. It was mixed emotions. I was like, it was almost like a scene in the Twilight Zone. You know, like everything around me just stopped, and I was the only one moving around. Everything else was a standstill. And
were you afraid?
That's one of the craziest things. I wasn't afraid. I didn't feel no fear. Whether I understood what real fear was at that moment, I don't know, because I didn't feel no fear. I was not afraid. I was angry because I was unable to stop, you know, the shooting. I was unable to stop my friend from getting killed. So it was basically, like I said, it just happened so fast. But no, I don't think fear even entered the equation at that moment in my life.
Mm-hmm. And so then you're thinking about revenge. And talk about sadness.
No, I don't think at that time whether I understood what sadness was. It did not register at that very moment. I just had revenge on my mind, and you know, what I perceived at that moment to be justice or absolute justice on his behalf was to go out and enact revenge. Mm-hmm. Of course, I didn't have a clue of what was really going on, but that's my perspective. That's how I seen it, you know. Nothing else registered, you know, right or wrong or none of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then, okay, where you left off before, a year later, a few years later?
Yeah, about a year later, we were already at war with this rival gang because of that shooting. So things had escalated to a higher level, and at age 16, I ended up getting locked up, and I was incarcerated for murder, attempt murder, and a firearm. And I was fighting the case. My so-called buddies or friends, you know, the gang I was in, collected a lot of money to get me a lawyer. Of course, I never got the lawyer because certain individuals just decided to keep the money. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going to prison. I went to trial on my case. I ended up with a public defender. I didn't have a clue about the law. The judge had offered me a 20-year cop-out, which, if I had any sense at the time, I would have taken the 20-year cop-out and served 10 years, which would have been 50% of the 20, and I did not accept it. And eventually I got convicted, and I ended up getting 70 years for the murder, attempt murder, and the weapons.
Well, did you not accept because you thought maybe you would get off altogether?
That was my thinking, yeah. That was my thinking. I'm going to beat this out. There's no way they can convict me. They don't got no proof. They don't got this. They don't got that. Of course, I think I was the only one that believed that. Nobody else believed that, but then, of course, it did not work out that way. I did not accept the cop-out, so I got found guilty. I also got sentenced consecutive on all my charges, which technically, or not technically, but law by law, it was unconstitutional because all the charges extended out the same crime, so by law, everything was supposed to have been ran concurrently. The smaller sentence eaten up by the bigger sentence, but in my case, it wasn't. To make matters worse, on appeal, the appellate courts agree with the sentences and upheld my sentence. And then we appealed to the Supreme Court, the highest courts in the land, and they, too, upheld my conviction in part. And vacated in part. They basically ran the two smaller charges into the bigger charges, but kept the murder charge and the attempt murder charge consecutive. They kept it ran consecutive, which was also unconstitutional, but they upheld it, and I served the sentence. You know, I did over 28 years in prison, 28 years, 3 months.
So when the guy was killed, did you ever know any of his family or anything? Did you know this person?
No, I did not know the person. I never seen them in my life. Only thing I knew that he was a rival gang member, and that was it. I never saw him in my life.
Okay. So then you went to prison at age 17?
16.
16? But you were...
I was tried as an adult. Uh-huh. Because Illinois had that law where you, even though you're a minor, if you commit an adult crime, you're charged as an adult. So at 17, I went to the county jail, and, yeah, I was charged as an adult.
What was it like at that age to have a 50-year sentence hanging over your head?
That's the craziest thing. It still didn't register. I don't think it registered too many years later as to how serious this whole thing was. I mean, at that age, everything was still a joke to me, you know. I was like in the twilight zone. There was no reality check there, you know. It was just, okay, whatever. It didn't register to, like, I think, like 6-7 years later, mm-hmm. when it really registered that, man, you know, you got all this time. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
And you told me once that even after you were locked up, like, you were just as involved in the gangs on the inside of the prison.
Oh, yeah, it made it worse. I mean, I went to prison, and instead of taking advantage of my education with all the time I had to serve, I didn't. I got deeply involved into the gang life, and I figured that I would rather be a shot caller or a ranking member of the gang than a member. Because my thinking was that if I could outthink this guy, or if I could think better than this guy, why should he have any say over me? Mm-hmm. And, of course, I thought I could outthink anybody. But the truth of the matter is that even with rank or going up in the rank and files, there's still a lot of things you have to do, a lot of criminal acts you have to carry out, you know, to prove your status, to prove who you are as an individual. Thing in prison, basically, it's really a no-win situation. Killers are guys that I never get in there, a dime a dozen. So it's not like you're in there and everybody's scared. I think nobody's scared, and that's what makes everything that much worse, because it's like you're walking on a minefield and a bomb could go off at any minute. And what I mean by that is that that's how guys, their mentality was. Mm-hmm. We were like walking time bombs ready to go off for any vital or any minor offense.
Oh. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP in Northampton. The show is out there. This is an interview that I'm playing with a friend of mine, David Perez from Chicago, talking about his time, his 28 years in jail and before.
Or insult, we're ready to fight or we're ready to kill somebody at a drop of a pin. It was crazy. But that was the mentality and that was the lifestyle of prison, you know. Everybody wanted to be tough. Everybody wanted to be a killer. And nobody at that time wanted to go home. Or if they wanted to go home, their actions said otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I got deeper involved in the gang life. And I did not take advantage of none of the educational aspects of the prison system. And I ended up losing time in prison. I became so deeply involved in the gangs that I would, every couple of years, be transferred from one prison to another because of my gang activity. It never actually got better. It just kept getting worse. And the more rank I obtained, the worse it became, you know.
You told me you were a general at one point, but I don't know what the rankings mean and what they are.
Well, we had different levels of rank. I mean, we had from generals to sergeants at arms. We had dons. We had captains. We had chiefs. I think we incorporated different levels of organizational ranks. We took the military ranks, and we took the ranks that are used within the mafia or other organizations. We took the titles because we had a chief, we had a don, we had a prince. So we incorporated many different titles and levels on an organizational level, you know, to give somebody the status he wanted or the recognition he wanted for this status, for this name, this title. So, yeah.
Can you give any examples of situations in prison where, like, the gangs and the rankings and whatever made a difference in terms of what happened in control and how did it all, like, play out? Can you give any specific?
Well, I one thing about men in prison, they read so much that they actually become, they're actually a step or two steps or 10 steps ahead of the game. They sometimes they see things before it happens, or sometimes they make the things happen. For instance, the leadership within the prison system, and what I mean by leadership, the leader of each gang has sat down together, and they had agreed to certain rules that will protect them at all costs. Meaning that if the gangs went to war, the membership will kill each other and it's okay. But you couldn't touch a leader. If you touch the leader, your own gang will kill you. So the leaders made sure they were protected at all costs. Even if the membership was expendable, they made sure they covered themselves. And I believe that during World War I or II, that was used by governments to protect the leaders. That's why Hitler and a lot of these other leaders at the time were never assassinated, because you couldn't assassinate the leaders, you know? Everybody else was okay to be assassinated, but not the leaders. Everything was controlled within the prison systems. The more drugs you had, the bigger control you had. I used to see other leaders control other leaders through drugs. I used to see leaders get together and make sure the prisons don't go on lockdown, because the prisons go on lockdown, that's bad for business. So we have to maintain the peace and the status quo at all times. So whatever happens on the street stays on the street. That's one world apart from this world we're in. This was a man-made world, so the rules were different. If we were deadly enemies in the street, now we're friends inside prison. We play basketball together. We play baseball together. And it was the craziest thing in the world, because on the street, we're killing each other. And in here, we're playing sports together, you know, and we're showing good sportsmanship towards one another and actually being friendly and not hostile towards one another. So it's the craziest thing, you know. The big difference is from the streets and the prison system.
Also, then how did you know in prison, how did you know who to be friends with and who to be enemies with?
Well, basically, an enemy is an enemy regardless. But we put our differences to the side temporarily. We could pick up our anger or whatever once we're back on the streets.
What was the role of the prison guards in all this?
Well, back then, the prison systems were open. They were basically ran by the gangs. Mm-hmm. So the guards basically, they come to work. It was just a job for them. They were not bad individuals. If a war was going to break off or some, they would want you to warn them so they can get the hell out the way. Uh-huh. They didn't want no part of it. They didn't intervene in the gang life. They intervened if they had no choice, and they had to intervene and had to try to take control of a situation. But for most parts, in those days when I was serving time, you know, in the 70s, 80s, even early 90s, the prisons were ran by the gangs. After 96, that's when things started to change, and the administration or the officers took back control of the prison system. But before then, that's the way it was.
So how did you make changes in your life while you were in prison?
I think the changes that happened in my life or occurred in my life was once I was in solitary confinement. I think that's towards the end of my sentence, that's where the changes started coming about in my life. I think before then, I was just a total mess, and I was constantly messing up.
But for the first 20 years or so, you were just continuing your the same
pattern. Not taking advantage of educational field within the system at that time was a big mess up for me, because I should have took advantage of it, and I didn't. And today I'm paying the price because I didn't. And towards the end of my sentence, once I was put in solitary confinement because I was deemed a threat to security, a threat to other inmates, basically that's when I had more than all the time in the world to really start thinking and analyzing and looking at things through different perspective. And I realized that if I didn't make the proper changes and I was released from prison, then I would end up probably just coming back in the same footsteps and ending back up in prison. So I think the changes started happening while in solitary confinement.
You told me you started meditating while you were in there, too.
You know what? That's the funniest thing, because I tried everything. Mm-hmm. And I even tried meditation. I tried yoga, breathing techniques, and they worked for a while. Mm-hmm. I just never had the patience to stick with it. And when I say they worked for a while, I mean, I might have did it for 6 months. I might have done it a year. I might have done it 2 years. But eventually, I just quit doing it. Mm-hmm. And I admit, a lot of the techniques were working, because I was more calm, I was more patient, I was more relaxed. I was no longer like in a hurry, you know, but and eventually in a while I stopped doing them altogether.
It sounds like it was an important part of your process to get where you are today.
Well, I think it was part of my journey. I've been through a lot of ups and downs. I let myself down, I let others down many a times, and basically it was, you know, my thinking. Even when I was doing things right, an old friend, an old ghost from the past will surface, and the next thing you know, we're hanging out and I'm doing things wrong again. And so the way I've been able to curve that now is by not hanging with them, you know, and making sure that I don't go through that process again. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you feel like you have, are there enemies out there from the past?
Yeah, I think when we live that kind of lifestyle, we are always going to have enemies. I think it's a thing of being conscious of your surroundings and always being alert and knowing how to move out the way and move out the way quickly. Yeah, I mean, some enemies, no matter how much time goes by, they're still going to be your enemies. So it's, even though my lifestyle is different, I know a lot of guys that has changed their life. Mm-hmm. And still ended up getting killed because they ran into an old enemy. Mm-hmm. And were unprepared for it. So basically what I do is I'm basically just always alert. And hopefully I will never encounter an enemy or a situation where I have to defend myself or get hurt or hurt someone else, you know. But I'm not saying it cannot happen. I'm just saying thus far it has not.
So when you're in solitary and when you were starting to see life differently, like what kind of changes came about within yourself or your perspective? How are you different now than you were when you were involved in the games?
I think today I'm more conscious of other people's feelings, and I hold myself accountable for my actions or how I treat others, and I think I'm more respectful towards others and more considerate towards others. I'm no longer looking at things from a game mentality, but from a human point of view or human mentality. Yes, we're all humans, and mm-hmm. we're all in this world. Mm-hmm. You know, whether we want to be or not, we're part of the moment. Mm-hmm. So I treat others the way I would want them to treat me, and that's with respect. Mm-hmm. And I avoid situations, I avoid problems, and if they do occur, instead of looking to fight my way out or fight my way through, I look for solutions or, you know, a way to solve it or keep the situation from escalating.
Mm-hmm. When you give inspirational talks and stuff, when you think about, you talk with young men who are 14, 15, 16, like, what do you say? How do you communicate with them ways to be more sensitive to other people's reactions when they're like swept up in?
Well, basically, I share my own personal experiences with them, and I let them know that my thinking landed me in prison for a very long time. I let them know that when their parents are trying to tell them something, it's not that their parents are trying to tell them what to do, it's that their parents are trying to help them not go through what they might have went through, because I let them know their parents, you know, they were once your age. At this age, whenever somebody gives us good advice, we get on the defense, you know, and we get hostile, and you know, I've been through all that, you know, and today I wish I would have listened to my parents. I would have never been in the situation I was in.
So when you got out after 28 years, how did you begin to transition to life on the outside?
Well, I had picked up a lot of trades while in prison. I had learned to paint professionally. I had learned to do handyman work, plumber, basic electrical work, drywall, landscaping. This, I do just about everything. And basically the way I advertised myself once I was out of prison was by going to churches that I know needed work and not charging them to do the work, but basically asking them, you buy the material and I'll do the work for free. Mm-hmm. And that was my way or my form of advertising my skills. And in return, what they were able to do for me was when somebody seen the good work I did and inquired about who did this work, they will give them my phone number, and that's how I started landing jobs, and that's how I started making a living. Today I try to give back. I still talk to at-risk youth. I talk to them as groups, and I also talk to them one-on-one. I do a lot of work for Paralyzed Veterans of America. I work with paralyzed veterans. I do a lot of work for the elderly. Fix their houses, paint their houses. Everything I do today is sort of my way of trying to give back, and I can never undo what I did, so I'm just trying to find a balance within myself, you know. So I try to live right. If I could take some time out of my life to help somebody and make a difference, I'd do it.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
So if you just tuned in, that was an interview with a friend of mine, David Perez from Chicago. Thanks, David, for sharing so much about your life. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. You can listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. I'm going to play a song. Oh, nope, not this. Oh, I missed a song. I'm going to look it up, but the song that David requested, for here, I'll play the Bike Lab PSA.
I found a bike today. It looks so good. Why did you throw?
to fix your bike, how to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it. Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Venga para el Bike Lab de Northampton y se divertirá mucho, le enseñará muchas lecciones cómo arreglar bicicletas.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue,
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Ya súbase a la bici, compa. Trépese a la de montaña, la bici urbana, la bici cross. Lléguele a la bicicleta. Ya de menos a la eléctrica o a la estática, ya no hay tos. Llegaré pedaleando en el viaje de allá pa' acá.
So I called David today, my friend who the previous interview was with, and asked him if he had any song requests, and he said, anything by Moby. And so this is Southside. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock.
See myself in the pouring home. See the light come over, no. I see myself in the pouring rain. I watch hope come over. We'll be right back.